You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, an expert explains the significance of Justice Stephen Breyer's retirement from the U.S. Supreme Court and what's next in the process of finding a new justice. Now, it's a cold stretch of winter here in Wisconsin, so how about a little bit of Mediterranean sunshine to liven up our kitchens? Our next guest grew up eating and cooking delicious Greek and Greek-American classics and uses those lessons and memories in her own home cooking, at her restaurant, and in her new cookbook. On this week's edition of Food Friday, we're talking about Mediterranean food and cooking with lots of Greek inspiration. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your favorite Mediterranean foods or recipes? Do you have a go-to olive oil, and what do you do with it? Did you grow up cooking with a family member who influenced how you approach cooking today? Do you have a question about cooking Greek food in particular? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Mina Stone is a chef and owner of the restaurant Mina's in New York. Her newest cookbook is Lemon, Love, and Olive Oil. Mina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Before we get to the food and some recipes, Mina, I want to talk about your upbringing with this Greek food, the memories, and the family you connect with it. Can you tell us a little bit about that that backstory and inspiration?
Sure. My parents met in Greece. My dad's American. My mother's Greek. And they were both studying. My dad was doing a study abroad program. And they met in Greece. And they moved to Boston, which is where I grew up. And I spent my summers with my Greek family every year. And I also, for a stint, my parents moved to Boston and then they moved back to Greece, where I went to preschool and kindergarten. And when I was in my 20s, I made the decision to move back again, where I spent a year with my grandmother on the island of Aegina. So I really spent a lot of time in the country, and I was thinking a lot about my memories and what brings me to the table, what inspires me to cook, when I was writing the book you mentioned, my second cookbook, and these stories of, you know, my upbringing and spending a lot of time with my Greek family really influenced the way I cook. I don't only cook Greek food, but it was really almost feels like something that's ingrained in me as an ethos.
And one part of your cooking, you talk about, in even in one of the recipes we're going to use, kind of making use of what you've got access to. Going through the recipes in your book, you know, there's sometimes four ingredients, sometimes six or seven ingredients. This is not super complicated stuff. Can you talk about your approach to, I guess, some simplicity in your cooking?
Sure. It's something that's really important to me. And I think that it is something that when a cook gets to know this, that it can be this source of real freedom in the kitchen when you're cooking. When I was around my grandmother and then my own experience of just living in New York City, it's the idea of having ingredients and be accessible, and also the idea of being able to have the knowledge to swap out one ingredient for another and to understand that was really important to me. So I think as a cook, especially as a Mediterranean cook, where the idea of the food is that it is extremely simple, but it's so delicious. You get some basics down and then you can really play with that.
I think we've got a question about one of your key ingredients. Becky is on the line in Newton. Becky, hi.
Hello. I just was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on how I know what type of olive oil to buy, what's good, what's not good. Some come in plastic, some come in glass, some are really expensive, some are cheap. Do I need one that's imported? Can I get one that's made in the U.S.? I'm so confused, and there's so many. I've heard some are bad and some are good, and I really don't know the difference.
Becky, thanks for that question. I'll admit, too, Mina, to standing there in a grocery store aisle, not even at a fancy grocery store, just being overwhelmed by choice. Can you give us some guidelines in choosing a good olive oil, especially for your kind of cooking?
Yeah, absolutely. I get this question a lot, and it is really confusing. Here's what I suggest. I suggest you do get olive oil in glass. I also suggest that you try and get olive oil from a single place, but a specific single place. So when you see Italian, 100% Italian olive oil, it's like a warning sign. You should see olive oil from the Koroneki variety of this part of Greece. So the closer you can get olive oil, where you can pinpoint the place that it's from, the higher quality it will be. Something that I really like as a really basic olive oil that's easily accessible in the US is the California brand olive oils. I find them to be really simple, clean, good quality. But if you have access to a great Middle Eastern shop or specialty Greek food shop, they have the tins of olive oil. So I would say glass or those big tins of olive oil where they're a great price and they're usually really high quality. Always get extra virgin. And I would say start smelling your olive oil, because once you start smelling it, you're going to be able to tell the difference of every single olive oil. I say that I don't know too much about wine. I hate to admit it, but it's true. But when it comes to olive oil, I feel like I can just tell by the smell, and everyone can. On another little note is that I find Italian olive oil to be really spicy and complex and an amazing olive oil. I find Greek olive oil to be really creamy, and almost, you can almost use it like it's butter. So it really depends what you're going for. I mean, I'm partial. I usually buy Greek olive oil, but those are the notes I have about those two countries and their olive oils.
Becky, thanks a lot for that question at 800-642-1234. Talking to Chef Mina Stone about her new cookbook, Lemon, Love, and Olive Oil. You can join in with your questions about Greek cooking, Mediterranean food, your favorites, or let us know your favorite recipe. 800-642-1234 is the number. All right, Mina, we met one ingredient there that's key. Let's meet another one in the title of your book, lemons. They show up in a lot of your recipes. I'm on board. I've just been getting into, like, I keep finding out that when a dish is missing something, lemon is often that thing it was missing. Can you talk about how important lemons are to you?
Yeah, lemon and salt, usually missing from something that you cook. I agree. I grew up with lemons seasoning everything. Greeks use it on absolutely everything. And I have always found it to be this very easy way to make something taste bright and delicious. It's an amazing way to cut a dish if it's a very rich dish. It is an easy way to make steamed greens or salad just pop and taste bright. And I always prefer it to vinegar. I like vinegar. It's completely appropriate, but there is something very clean about lemon juice that I like to use. And so, I mean, people ask me often how I seasoned a dish that I make, and it got to be almost like this joke where what I would say over and over again is lemon and olive oil and salt, and that was it. And so, yes, if you have those three things, you can really harness in that power of seasoning a dish and making it taste great.
Let's meet a recipe where we have some of this in action now. You've shared a couple. We've got them online at WPR.org/Food Friday. You'll have to help me with the pronunciation here. I think this is a kale salad cacio e pepe inspired.
Yeah, so that's my Italian inspired recipe in the book, cacio e pepe.
Thank you.
Italian, yep.
And tell us about the recipe a little bit.
Yeah, so the recipe is, I love that really rich pasta dish. It's something my husband makes. It is rich with pecorino cheese and black pepper, and it's so good. And I decided one day, I was tearing up kale, and I'm still not over the kale salad. I crave it and I love it. And I thought I would take the flavors that you put in that pasta dish and put it on kale instead. And that's how that dish was born.
You can find that recipe online at WPR.org/Food Friday. Mina Stone is with us, chef. She's talking to us about her new cookbook featuring Greek American inspired cuisine. It's called Lemon, Love, and Olive Oil. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever had something in a Greek or Italian restaurant? Or maybe in Greece itself that you tried to recreate at home? Or do you wish you could? How'd it go? What do you want to know about Greek cooking, about Mediterranean cooking? Do you have a favorite kind of olive oil and a favorite way to use it? Are you a big fan of lemons in your cooking? What do you do with them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue our Food Friday conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday conversation now with Mina Stone, author of the Greek-inspired cookbook called Lemon, Love, and Olive Oil. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you an olive oil connoisseur yourself? What are the favorite kinds of olive oil you've managed to find here in Wisconsin? Are you a fan of Greek food? Did you grow up eating and or cooking Greek food, Greek American food? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your comments, your experiences, or your questions for our guest. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Find a couple of recipes from Mina over at WPR.org/Food Friday. Mina, I want to check out the other recipe you shared with us now. This one is spaghetti with sardines, lemon, and arugula. And this, we were talking earlier about how you like to cook with what you have on hand. And this dish is an example of that, right?
It sure is. I love pasta. I think most people do. And I love to think about it. But the truth is that in practice, pasta for me is always something I throw together with what I open up and find in my cupboard. So that recipe was born of that. I opened up my cupboard. I said, okay, I have a can of sardines. I have garlic. I have onions. And I have arugula and lemons. And I made this bright pasta that's really delicious and has the flavor of the sardines and the lemons and everything that you want in. I think of it as a summery pasta, but you can make it anytime. And I realized as I made it over and over again, I was like, cool, this is a recipe that stuck around. I'm going to include it in my book because now I actually seek out to buy the ingredients from my cupboard. But that is to say also, I think it stays with that idea we were talking about earlier, where if you don't have arugula, you can substitute parsley or you can substitute kale or a green that you have on hand that you think would taste great on the pasta.
It sounds great. Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Don is with us in Madison. Don, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Don?
I want to bring up my favorite Greek food is skordalia, which is sort of like their version of hummus. That is used as a sauce. And if you're a garlic lover, this stuff is garlic heaven. But very few people seem to know about it, so I wanted to mention it.
Where have you run into that, Don?
There's a Greek restaurant in New York called Piriali, which is where I had it. And then I liked it so much, I bought their cookbook, and I've been making it here ever since.
Excellent. Well, thanks for sharing that with us, Don. Skordalia, Mina, am I saying that right?
Yeah. Okay, it's okay. Get ready for it. It's skordalia.
Skordalia.
But you can say skordalia in an American accent.
Excellent. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, Don, that is one of my favorite Greek recipes. My grandmother, there is a recipe for it in the cookbook. And I mentioned in the cookbook that this recipe was something that my grandmother would make like a vat of, and she would keep it in the fridge, and we would just, like you said, use it as a dip or a sauce for everything that we ate throughout the week. And it is very garlicky. I mean, I feel like Americans faint because it calls for, you know, I don't my, they would put like 8 to 10 garlic cloves. It is spicy, and it's very good for you. But in my book, I mention this. I feel like it's slight blasphemy, but I do sometimes tone down the garlic, but sometimes I rev it up when you how depending on how you're feeling.
Don, it sounds awesome. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. We'll go next to Kathleen in Sun Prairie. Kathleen, hi.
Hi. My question is, I tried to make avgolimono soup, and the broth separates when I put the egg mixture in. So what's the secret?
So that's an egg and lemon soup, if the internet is telling me right, as I quickly look it up, Mina.
That's right. So a lot of Greek recipes, I was not kidding that we put lemon in everything. A lot of Greek recipes, especially soup, uses this binder called avgolemono, and it is an egg and lemon mixture that basically makes a soup very creamy and bright. You can make it thin. You can also make a thicker version of it as a sauce for dolmades or for meat dishes. So what you're doing wrong, or what I would suggest that you try next time so that it doesn't separate, is leave your eggs out at room temperature and make sure they're at room temperature. Whisk them in a bowl, and then you need to temper the egg. So you need to add a little bit of broth at a time, whisking it in to temper them and bring them up to temperature. So I would add very slowly about 8 ladlefuls of broth before you then put that mixture into your soup. And you're whisking the whole time. When you add it back into your soup, keep it at a bare simmer for 5 minutes and then stop cooking it.
Okay.
All right, Kathleen, let us know how it turns out. I'm curious. You're not that far away. Drop some by the studio next week. Thanks.
It's a wonderful soup.
Oh, good.
It is.
Thank you.
Thanks again for calling in, Kathleen, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Mina Stone. Her new cookbook is called Lemon, Love, and Olive Oil. Find a couple recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. Mina, you said earlier that that sardine pasta lemon recipe you think of as a summer dish. But I don't know, I like having bright stuff with lemon in it. I love, like, it's a cold winter here in Wisconsin. I don't know how you're doing it in New York right now. But like having that lemon stuff lets me cheat a little bit and feel like I'm tasting some summer in the middle of winter. Do you find that you've eaten this food in Greece, of course, on the Mediterranean? You've eaten it, I'm sure, in New York winter. Does it give you that feeling of being back in Greece?
It does. I mean, I can't really say. I know there's different versions of this pasta. I don't think I ever had it in Greece. I just made it in my New York City home. But, you know, you are right. It's kind of a catch-22 because citrus is a winter thing. I mean, it is in season during the winter months for us in cold areas of the world. So it does, you know, it's both. And it reminds me of summer, but I also, you know, you just have to make your pasta with your sardines in the winter too. So yes, I agree with you.
I want to check out some dessert here. You've got a super, I think people are going to be blown away that this is in it, super lemony olive oil cake. It sounds actually really good to me. Can you tell us about this? Like, what's it like? What's its texture like?
Sure. It's a really easy cake to make. It's very moist. It is really delicious. I find that it is a cake where it's minimal work for maximum payoff. I just spent the week with my mother in Boston, who said that the problem with my cake when you make it is that you can't stop eating it. And I said, Mom, but I mean, isn't that a point? Isn't that the point that you make a cake that you want to eat? The recipe has a lot more olive oil in it than most olive oil cakes. Don't be scared of it. If you see the recipe, it works. Make it, because I think that from an olive oil cake, I want to get that hit of olive oil. I want it to be very moist, and I want to be able to smell the fragrance of the olive oil in it. And then that is complemented by the freshness of the lemon juice.
All right, now I'm going to see if I've learned an olive oil lesson from you earlier, Mina. Do I want to make this with that Greek, that simpler palette of Greek olive oil, or that tangy Italian? I'm guessing I'm going to go Greek. Am I right?
I mean, you could go Greek, but this is, again, I will say that I really believe this. I think that you need good olive oil for it, but you should use exactly what you have. If you have a great Italian olive oil, use that. If you have good Greek olive oil, use that. Just use what you have, but just make sure it's good olive oil, because you'll be able to taste it in the cake if it's not.
Mina, just our last few moments or so, can you leave us with some words of encouragement to dive into Greek cooking, whether we're eating somebody else's cooking or trying making our own at home?
Absolutely. I think that the takeaway from Mediterranean food is that it's very simple to prepare, and all you really have to do is season it correctly. And it is a great place to start cooking and not feel intimidated and feel like you're making great food that's also very good for you.
We'll leave it there. Mina, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Mina Stone is a chef. She talked to us on Food Friday about her new cookbook called Lemon, Love, and Olive Oil. We've got a couple recipes that she shared over at WPR.org/Food Friday. Not that cake, but what do we got? We got spaghetti with sardines, lemon, and arugula, and a kale salad inspired by an Italian pasta dish. And there's still time for you to share your memories, your favorite Greek dishes that you've eaten or made at home or abroad. Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. It has been a busy week in Wisconsin politics. There have been court rulings back and forth on things like election absentee ballot drop boxes to some big budget news, a surplus in the state, and of course, a debate over what to do with that surplus. We've covered some of those issues here on Central Time. Well, on The Morning Show at 7, it's the State Capitol Report. We've got our very own State Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson starting the week off with updates on some of the top stories. Get the details, the latest, whatever happens over the weekend. A lot of twists and turns even going on today. And as always, you can join in with your questions for Sean. He will bring you up to date. Follow his reporting over at WPR.org, by the way. That's Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Justice Stephen Breyer officially announced his retirement from the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday. President Joe Biden reiterated a promise to replace Breyer with a black woman, talking yesterday.
While I've been studying candidates' backgrounds and writings, I've made no decision except one. The person I will nominate will be someone with extraordinary qualifications, character, experience, and integrity. And that person will be the first black woman ever nominated to the United States Supreme Court. It's long overdue, in my view.
Breyer's replacement would join a court that currently has a conservative majority of 6-3. We're talking about Justice Stephen Breyer's retirement, what it means for the future of the Supreme Court. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about Justice Breyer's decision to retire and to announce it this week? Do you think it was the right move? What are you hoping to see in the replacement process? What are your thoughts on the direction the court has moved in recent years? Do you have questions for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are there particular issues that are before the court or that might come before the court that you are particularly concerned about? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kimmy King is a professor and interim chair of the Political Science Department at the University of North Texas. Kimmy, welcome back to Central Time.
Always good to be on public radio.
Can you talk about the timing of Justice Breyer's retirement announcement and his planned retirement date?
It's actually not so unexpected, given the age of Justice Breyer and the fact that typically when you look in the past at Supreme Court justices, they typically try to retire under the administration of, if it's the same party of the president that appointed them. And given President Biden's slumping public approval ratings, given the fact that he has struggled with getting his agenda off the ground for public policy, it's a recognition that if he's going to make this move, he needs to do it now.
Justice Breyer, among all the justices, has made the case pretty prominently that we shouldn't think of justices as political or thinking about these succession issues and things like that. And yet you think this was on his mind?
It's on every justice's mind as they grow later in life to think about what their legacy will be. And certainly there was great concern about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And the thinking is now, looking back in retrospect, when you think about the fights that the Republicans and Democrats had, people look back and say, well, perhaps Justice Ginsburg should have retired much earlier. And I also want to address something that this view about the justices being political. You're absolutely correct, Rob, that Justice Breyer, you know, shied away from that. And if you look at his actual voting while on the court, typically, he is lumped in to be one of the three liberals still on the court. But of those, he was always considered to be the moderate liberal. And so that is also striking about Breyer's decision to step down right now.
I want to talk a little bit about Justice Breyer's term on the court. A lot of the write-ups, the analysts looking at this say he was somebody who worked to try to build consensus when he could, to negotiate with judges across the ideological boundaries. Do you think that's an accurate read?
It absolutely is, and it's empirically proven scientifically, you know, that if you look at his voting behavior, he was perhaps a bit more conservative compared to other Democratic appointees. He tended to have the smallest percentage of liberal votes, voting, you know, regularly with Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan, but compared to their voting records, certainly you could not say that he was more liberal than them. And he voted, for example, with the majority to allow the police to take DNA samples from people arrested. He has weighed in on any number of issues with a balanced perspective, is how I think people will look at Justice Breyer's legacy.
One thing that struck me yesterday, we had a pollster, Charles Franklin, on, a Wisconsin pollster, who had shared some of his numbers about what people think of individual Supreme Court justices. Justice Breyer stood out as the person, the justice that people knew the least about. Most people said, I don't know enough about him to have an opinion one way or the other. Does that mean something?
Yeah, only 20% of Americans said they were able to express an opinion about him. That's certainly not something you could have said about Justice Ginsburg or Justice Scalia. It is striking that he stayed below the radar. What he's also known for being on the court, is being one of the court's intellectuals, often asking questions that seemingly annoyed justices, other justices, because they seemed very intellectual and sometimes, you know, letting the debate drawing in. So it was really just him arguing with whoever the counsel was, arguing the case before the court. So I think that while many of the people appearing before the court are very aware of Breyer, it is clear that people outside the court may not even know he was on the court.
Talking to Kimmy King, professor, interim chair of the Political Science Department at the University of North Texas, one of our go-to Supreme Court watchers here on Central Time, talking about the announced retirement of Justice Stephen Breyer and the confirmation process with the nomination and then confirmation process coming up. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on this, your questions, your hopes, your fears. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Kimmy, we have President Biden saying he's going to appoint a black woman to the U.S. Supreme Court. Can you talk about the significance of that?
Well, it is important, and I think President Biden is also coming to terms with some of his own legacy that he has to deal with. he has to deal with. Remember that he oversaw the nomination of Supreme Court Justice Thomas to the bench and the allegations made by Anita Hill, a Black woman, that Thomas had harassed her, really pivoted everyone to what we look back and say the combination of that and a record number of women being elected to Congress claimed 1992 as the year of the woman. And so I think Biden has tried to rehabilitate some of his image that comes from those days because it was clearly marked by the allegations that the committee was behaving in a racist manner and that Black women would not get a fair hearing in front of the U.S. Congress. So that's no doubt playing part of where he's going. It's also an endeavor. Every president also looks to see what his legacy may be. And this in part allows him to create that legacy in much the same way that former President Obama was trying to recognize a changing society with his nomination of Sonia Sotomayor, the first Latina, to the Supreme Court.
There's been some criticism from Republicans along the lines of just pick the most qualified justice, don't go for a demographic. Others have pointed out that Ronald Reagan, coming into office, promised to appoint, said he was going to appoint a woman to the Supreme Court, who ended up being Sandra Day O'Connor. Do we have precedent for this kind of thing?
Absolutely. In fact, going back in time, you have seen different people say that there needed to be, and going back quite some time, a Jewish representative on the court. That there was a time when we had not seen anyone like that. And so I think that it's something that every president looks to. You also see that presidents talk about having different perspectives and ideological perspective that they want to see on the court. I think what President Biden will need to do as he moves forward, he tried to lay the groundwork a little bit yesterday by coming out swinging that he's going to choose the most qualified person for it. And that person is also going to be a woman, you know, a Black woman. It's pretty clear that he recognizes he is going to have a bit of a challenge on this.
Kimmy King is with us from the University of North Texas. We're looking at the retirement of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer and the upcoming nomination and confirmation process. You can join in 800-642-1234. What are you hoping for from the nominee to replace Justice Breyer on the U.S. Supreme Court, whoever that might be? Are there issues where you want to know what a nominee for the Supreme Court thinks about it? What issues are those? What are your hopes for the confirmation process and how it's going to play out in the Senate? Do you have questions about how all this works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with University of North Texas political scientist Kimmy King about the retirement of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, officially announced yesterday to happen at the end of his term later this year. Now a nomination and confirmation process will kick off. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your reactions, your questions about how all this works. If you're on one side or the other, do you want to see this be a big process, a big debate in the Senate, or do you want to see smooth sailing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Kurt is with us in Milton. Kurt, hi.
Hello. Hey, you know, I also didn't know anything about Justice Breyer, and you know, maybe that's good. What you've said about him is really encouraging. So my observation on this is that I also think it's very good to have women represented and ethnic, you know, representation on the court. But I think that this announcement is not good. It makes it seem like a political thing, like this is a prerequisite. I think that it should be a tiebreaker. He should pick the best person that he wants, and then if you can't decide, then the female and the, you know, genetic makeup might be a tiebreaker.
Gotcha. Kurt, thanks for the call. Kimmy, what do you think about President Biden not doing what Kurt said, just putting that right on the table right off the bat?
So what's really interesting about the good points that your caller, you know, is making is that the nomination of judges and justices has always been political. In fact, going back to the reason why we even have judicial review today, Marbury v. Madison in 1803 was really fundamentally about a battle between the two parties at the time regarding the power of the president to be able to turn down appointments that potentially had been put forward by a prior president. And in terms of the issue, so it's always been political. It's just that it's become even more politicized and polarized as we've become more politicized as a society. In terms of an equal factor, that's exactly where, if you look at equal protection law, there's this, it depends on the area, whether it's employment or higher education. You cannot have a kind of quota, a numerical, you get it just because. It has to be a holistic review, or it's that otherwise equally qualified. And so you're going to have the qualifications to be there in the first place. I would point out, interestingly enough, that when they talked about Amy Coney Barrett and her nomination process and the fact that she came from Notre Dame, she was in some ways non-traditional if you looked at other justices who've been on the court, who have been from Ivy Leagues. And there was actually consternation in some ways that she was outside of the box. So as we look at these candidates, Biden and his team are going to be looking at a whole bunch of different things, including how they're going to get it through a divided Senate 50-50 without having to force the issue of having Kamala Harris, you know, do the tie-breaking vote. And so it is going to be, without a doubt, the same issues that get raised as we go through this confirmation process that your caller is raising.
Kurt, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Let's talk about that confirmation process now. The filibuster, where, you know, you need 60 votes to do things in the Senate, no longer applies, right, to Supreme Court justices. That's how Republicans were able to get a few nominees through over President Trump's term. So how hard do you think it's going to be for Democrats to get 50 and maybe one more, or get that tiebreaker?
So, you know, what it really boils down to, and you've seen this with the concern about Senators Manchin and Sinema, who, you know, conservative Democrats who've they've assisted the Republicans in essentially blocking Biden's agenda in some ways. One of the things about nominating someone that has already been through the federal court nomination process, whether they've been a district court judge or an appellate court judge, the president can look to that and say, hey, Sinema and Manchin, you supported this person at the lower court levels. Why is it now, when we're going to the Supreme Court, she is no longer qualified to serve? And it puts some of the onus back on people that might be opposed to a candidate he puts forward. And so I think Biden's going to weigh that heavily. And quite honestly, I think that that is going to overshadow everything that he does.
There was a lot of attention to, like, the Build Back Better Act. You mentioned Senators Manchin and Sinema not getting on board to overcome the filibuster on that. How have Democrats held together, though, on all those other court appointments? And there have been a lot of them, right?
Actually, what's striking about Sinema and Manchin, that if you look at their support for Biden's lower court nominees, they have not opposed a single one. And so that's definitely something that everybody is looking to, and why the people on President Biden's shortlist are thought, in some ways, the top candidates where they are placed. And it's because of having that prior support. And you've even seen in Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, the fact that she has district court and court of appeal approval and had some Republican support even at the lowest court level. So that's going to be another issue even to go after Republicans on.
Talking to Kimmy King from the University of North Texas about Justice Stephen Breyer's retirement announcement this week and the upcoming process to replace him. You dropped one name there, Kimmy. Can you talk about who people's eyes are on right now as possible nominees?
So in my mind, the person that is out front the most and is getting the most attention is Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, who was confirmed last year to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. And the reason why the D.C. Circuit is so important is it's considered to be one of the most powerful appellate courts in the country. She also has a history as a former public defender. That, too, would make her different from some of the other people who have been appointed to a Supreme Court justice. Strikingly about Brown Jackson, it offers an opportunity to kind of get a kind of payback a little bit, because she replaced the now Attorney General Merrick Garland, who you may remember was a failed attempt on the part of the Obama administration to try to get him appointed. And so she actually replaced him on the D.C. Circuit. And so people are looking at her because she's already been involved in a case involving, say, for example, the White House documents that they should be released to the Congressional Committee reviewing January 6th. And so it's thought that she's kind of proved some of her governmental capacity there for recognizing support for policies that the Biden administration supports. And every president tries to put judges or justices on the bench that they think will fulfill their legacy. And you saw that even with former President Trump being unhappy about some decisions that came out of judges and justices themselves, that he felt he deserved more support from them because he had been responsible for their appointments. And that's not how it works. Just because Biden puts whoever this is on the bench, that is absolutely no guarantee that they are going to back the president's policies, as presidents have learned all too well in difficult times.
Even supposing that President Biden nominates someone, they get confirmed that they're more or less reliably liberal on the court. In the near term, how much difference does that make with the, to be crass, 6-3 conservative majority?
Yeah, really not clear. What does this make any difference at all? And here's where it gets interesting, that justices themselves can change over the life of their vote, or they may turn out to not be the justice that the president hoped that they would be. And you have seen out of Justice Gorsuch and out of Chief Justice Roberts, they have departed from their conservative colleagues. What's striking about Breyer leaving the court is that he did have a little bit of an ability to cobble together, it seems, we don't know really the inner workings of the court, to kind of moderate more some of these schisms between conservatives and liberals. And that's why he did not like those labels and thought that they were worthless for looking at the court. But in terms of actually making changes on the ground for where we are right now and cases that are pending in the court or might be up next year, it's not clear that it makes any difference at all.
In our last minute or so, Kimmy, Justice Breyer is still on the court. There's some big issues before the court. We're waiting for decisions or about to hit the court. What do you have your eye on in particular?
Oh, gosh. There are so many different ones. I think the one that everybody is watching, that everybody is going to be talking out, are going to be the abortion cases that are out there right now. I'm down in Texas, but we've also got a case out of Mississippi that everyone is watching very closely. Any issue related to immigration, all the things that are big picture right now, right? You're going to want to watch, because Democrats are going to use it to say, see, this is why you need to leave us in power. We need to change the balance of power on the court moving forward. So those hot issues, abortion, immigration, criminal procedure has been one of those as well in the past, but it doesn't seem to be playing such a dominant role right now. And then, of course, there may be cases that are coming up that relate to former President Trump and any level of litigation that's currently moving through the courts relating to him. Those are all going to be ones that potentially have the ability to leave a mark on Breyer's legacy if he doesn't sort of make statements as he's going out the door about what he thinks about these issues.
Kimmy, as always, thanks for joining us today.
Always good to be a part of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good to talk to you, Rob.
You too. That's Kimmy King, professor and interim chair of political science at the University of North Texas, looking at the latest on the Supreme Court. Monday on Central Time, a Wisconsin doctor makes the case for gun locks at home. That's Monday on Central Time.